This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Bill Raggio and Tom Jocelyn, the senior fellows for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. They keep the Long War Journal. And we're watching Afghanistan and the decision by the United States and its allies to leave Afghanistan to the security of the Afghan government in Kabul and the Afghan National Army and the Afghan police. However, we're looking at the Taliban not following a similar timeline of negotiation, but closing the net around Kabul. Bill, a very good evening to you. Your newest report is that the Taliban has entered Kunduz City and taken 17 more districts control. What is the significance of Kunduz? Good evening to you, Bill.
Good evening, John. Yeah, and since I wrote that, I think I've counted two or three more districts that have fallen to the Taliban. So we're in the 19-20 range. This is just over the weekend. That's about 5% of the districts in Afghanistan. Think of districts as counties in here in U.S. states. The Afghan government was only able to retake two of them. This is really showing how unprepared the Afghan military is. But most importantly, that is important. Kunduz City, the Taliban looked like they entered the city. It doesn't look like it. The New York Times reported that the Taliban entered the city and has fanned out into several neighborhoods, and there's fighting inside the city. Kunduz City is the capital of Kunduz province. It's probably one of the largest cities in the Afghan north. It's very significant. The Taliban briefly took control of Kunduz City twice, once before, and held it for about 2 weeks each time, and once in 2015, once in 2016. And the only way that the Taliban were able to be ejected was when U.S. Special Forces came in, organized the Taliban, called in U.S. airstrikes, and still there was heavy fighting to get the Taliban out. That's one of those instances. That's when the U.S. launched an airstrike and hit a hospital by mistake because the Special Forces guys were so tired operating on two, 3 days straight without sleep. Mistakes are made in war. It's tragic. What we're seeing now, John, Kunduz isolated. Okay, maybe it's something they could deal with. 20 districts falling really bad. 8 of them were in one province, by the way, in Chakar. So the Taliban basically took control of half of the province in the course of a weekend. The Taliban are having some very significant success in the north. And it's the north itself that is important. This is where the power brokers, the Dostums of the world, of the Afghan world, where their power, their base of power is. And if they start losing control of that territory, where does the Afghan government go if the Taliban starts sweeping up from the south and the east and starts to surround Kabul and maybe has success with it? Where does the Afghan government draw its power? The Afghan government, the Afghan military is going to have to start. We've been talking about this for several weeks on your show. They're going to have to at some point they're going to have to take forces from the south to try and defend the north and eject the Taliban from these districts. And when they do that, the Taliban is going to take advantage of that in the south and consolidate their control there. The Afghan government's in a serious catch-22, and what's happening in the Afghan north is surprising even to me, who's tracked this very closely. I am surprised at the level of success that the Taliban is having at this point. Can the Afghan military reorganize? That's the real question here.
Any instance of blue-on-blue in the north, betrayal, opening doors, opening the back doors, you sit there at your command post, anything like that, Bill?
Yes, we are. Well, not overt. So what we're seeing is the Taliban are surrounding these districts, sending in tribal leaders, or tribal elders, or other influential figures. And in a lot of these cases, these districts are falling not from fighting, but just because the Taliban are like, look, the writing is on the wall. You guys either fight to the death here or you surrender and we'll let you go. And in a lot of cases, the Afghan military and police and the tribal forces that are fighting there, they're trying to defend these areas. They've just collapsed. They've caved. I saw a video where the Taliban had to be a dozen U.S. Humvees, U.S. supplied Humvees that were given to the Afghan military. So they're taking control of bases. In one instance, though, so the Taliban is trying to put this message out that, look, if you surrender to us, you will be treated fairly. The Taliban, you know, and that cascades. The next district where the Taliban roll up, they could say, look, we let these guys go. You saw it. No one was harmed. And so that's playing into this. You have a low morale, low fighting spirit in the Afghan military is what I'm seeing now, particularly in the north, which is shocking. But in some instances, so for instance, in one district in Takhar, the Taliban they captured everyone there that was in a fight, and they killed the head of the national directorate, the local, the district leader of the national directorate of security. Those are the ones that the Taliban will not let go. And that also sends a message. It's telling the Afghan troops and police, we'll let you go, but these guys aren't acceptable. That could cleave, divide between the two, and it may inspire, in some cases, Afghan security forces killing members of the NDS in order to ingratiate themselves with the Taliban. That's just a theory. We haven't seen that happen yet. But given what I've seen in Afghanistan over the last 10 years, I wouldn't be surprised.
Tom, from Al Jazeera, this statement over the weekend. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani has replaced two top ministers charged with managing the country's faltering security as the Taliban presses on with their campaign to capture new territory. The shakeup of the Defense and Interior Ministry portfolios comes as violence surges and peace talks remain deadlocked. We also have the report from Pakistan from the Prime Minister that he will not permit CIA bases in Pakistan in any fashion to project power into Afghanistan. Does this connect directly to what Bill just reported, those collapses of the districts? Does this connect to, in any fashion, the U.S.'s obligations to sustain the Afghan government if they're switching chairs here at the last moment?
Yeah, it certainly doesn't speak well for the Afghan government at this point that they're still shuffling the deck chairs on the deck of a sinking ship, it sounds like. They're trying to figure out who within their ranks can lead forces and fight on here. And this is something that should have been figured out a while ago, many months ago, but they're still trying to figure out, I guess, what their leadership is going to be for this battle against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and other jihadists. And it just doesn't make any sense, really, that they're this far behind the curve. I think, you know, a lot of what's happened here is that the jihadis, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, they're not confused. They have a very simple message. They have a simple narrative. They know what they're all about. They're all about taking over the country of Afghanistan and reinstalling its Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. The Afghan government and the American side have been completely confused for years now and have had competing narratives about what's going on, none of which are really beholden to reality or set in reality. And so now the Afghan government is scrambling basically to deal with this idea that they're going to have a post-American, after the American withdrawal, that they're going to have to figure out how to fight on their own and figure out how to try and keep the jihadis at bay. And it doesn't speak well that they're basically shuffling these key positions at this late stage.
The Pakistan government, is that a surprise that they will not in any fashion allow the U.S. to project power into Afghanistan? That is how we started this war 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's not a surprise at all. Remember, Imran Khan actually praised Osama bin Laden as a martyr after, you know, in a speech not too long ago. So, you know, Pakistan has always been a duplicitous ally at best in this fight against terrorists. And they are all too happy to get the U.S. out of the region. And, you know, this also speaks to a bigger problem here with the U.S. posture going forward, which is that President Biden envisioned that he could withdraw all the entire American footprint from Afghanistan and still have this over-the-horizon capability to attack pinprick targets at a distance who threaten the U.S. or its allies or the U.S. homeland. And at this point, it looks like that horizon is getting further and further away because there's really the U.S. hasn't secured basing in the region. Pakistan is not going to allow them to have a base there at the moment. And so it looks like they're going to have to go back to basically further, bases in the Gulf, which have a much greater distance to hit targets in Afghanistan. And even then, basically, the model would be to try and take out select terrorists here or there. So this is at this point, what you're looking at is an American posture that is not dissimilar to where it was in the 1990s in terms of being that far away from the battlefield in Afghanistan.
And the Afghan government, Tom, to your understanding, is the Afghan government in conversation with Washington? Has it been in conversation with Washington about what is going to happen the day after the U.S. has withdrawn. Do we know if there are not negotiations between Kabul and the Taliban, but between Kabul and Washington?
I mean, there are conversations, but from the outward rhetoric coming out of Washington is so delusional that I can't imagine these conversations are very productive. I mean, remember the official position of the State Department, which has been taking the lead here on all this for quite some time, is that there needs and the Defense Department has endorsed this wholeheartedly, is that there needs to be a negotiated political settlement for the conflict in Afghanistan. There's and that the Afghan government needs to take part in this peace process that's going to lead to a negotiated settlement. This is entirely unhinged from reality. There's absolutely no basis in reality for this whatsoever. The Taliban is simply on the march trying to take over the entire country. And meanwhile, the U.S. and its allies are telling the Afghan government that they should be beholden to a non-existent peace process when they should have been saying, you know, basically get your brass knuckles on for the fight ahead because you're going to be fighting on your own here very soon.
Tom Joslin, Bill Raggio, Senior Fellows, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They keep the Long War Journal. When we come back, contractors. The contractors in Afghanistan. What next? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Raggio and Tom Joslin, senior fellows of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They keep the Long War Journal with their colleagues. This is a chronicle of these 20 years extending now of Afghanistan and the larger story of the Ummah, the jihadists stretching from the Hindu Kush to the Mediterranean. Right now we're focusing on Afghanistan because of these next week's decisions must be made. Bill, the New York Times is reporting this from General Kenneth McKenzie, head of Pentagon Central Command, overseeing Afghanistan. I am concerned about the ability of the Afghan military to hold on after we leave, the ability of the Afghan Air Force to fly, in particular, after we remove the support for those aircraft. The issue is at the center of torturous discussion, says the New York Times, among officials in the Biden administration who are trying to devise workarounds for the myriad problems associated with President Biden's decision to withdraw. Officials at the Pentagon say that one possible solution would be to transfer contracts with private companies now paid for by the United States to the Afghan government. Bill, at the heart of this, the Afghan government does not have an ability to hold on to the contractors, and I cannot imagine the contractors will pay without will stay without being paid.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct, John. And the other issue, too, is will the contractors be protected under U.S. laws, these contracts are transferred to the Afghan government? That's always a very big issue of whether who has actual, the legal ability to prosecute them. Because sometimes the Afghan government or other, you know, foreign governments can be quite capricious in their how they handle contractors. So you're going to be a very big, you know, A, if you can't pay them, you know, good luck. And B, if you can't ensure that they'll have some form of Western protections, then, you know, how are you going to get contractors to work in country? And then the other issue, which is, I mean, look at what's happening at this with the security situation. Where are these contractors going to be based within Afghanistan? We just discussed how the security is deteriorating greatly in the north. It's deteriorating around Kabul, the south, and the east. The east may as well be Taliban-controlled territory at this time. I know that that's not the full case. But, you know, these things are teetering. And if you're a contractor, you're a Western contractor, where do you go inside of Afghanistan to work to support the Afghan military? And, you know, look, U.S. officials, it's, you know, they're waking up to the fact that the Afghan military probably isn't going to be able to fly its Air Force. I wouldn't say probably. It's highly likely that within a year you will have most of its most of the Afghan military or Air Force won't be able to fly. I mean, this is just the reality of the situation. Without those contractors, it's a guarantee.
Tom, that item about how the Pakistani prime minister says the CIA cannot base in Pakistan into Afghanistan, the inference there is that the CIA is seeking to be present because, is that because we're looking at acknowledgement that the Siraj Haqqani and the Haqqani network represent the Al-Qaeda and that Al-Qaeda is present in the zone, the gray zone between Pakistan and Afghanistan? Is that what is, I can't think of why the CIA would concern itself with the Taliban.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the idea is that they have to worry about suppressing the international terrorist threat that will inevitably flow out of Afghanistan post-American withdrawal. The problem is, and this is where this all becomes a tangled mess, and which Bill and I have documented for many years now, is that, you know, the point is that the terrorists that they're worried about posing an international threat are embedded in the Taliban insurgency and are fighting to overthrow the government of Kabul. And so it's mainly just an issue of the priorities at hand day to day for the jihadis. It's not a matter of, you know, basically you have one guy who's devoted to international affairs and then everybody else is local, which is basically the model the U.S. government's been operating under. And it just doesn't make sense. I mean, the real truth of the matter is that you guys that are fighting on the ground right now against the government of Afghanistan could very easily be repurposed for a plot in the West or somewhere else in the future. So this is it's a continuum. There's no very hard line. But basically, they want to have the ability to take out any terrorist who pops up, any international terrorist who pops up, who they can recognize and take them out. And that's a very difficult task, even with American forces in country, because, as I said, you know, basically Al-Qaeda and its allies are enmeshed in the insurgency.
Bill, does it surprise you to read in the AP report from Kabul, Afghanistan, that the previous president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, says that extremism is at present at its highest point and that the U.S. has failed in its mission over 20 years? Is there anything surprising about this, Bill?
Nothing surprising whatsoever, John. This is something that Tom and I have meticulously documented for the past, I don't know, 15 years, about how as Tom discussed, it's that Taliban-Al-Qaeda bond, and that bond has grown. Al-Qaeda, how is the Taliban so successful in the North? Al-Qaeda convinced Tajiks and Uzbeks and these disparate groups. It got them together and got them to integrate with the Taliban and fight under the Taliban's banner and help them with recruiting and help them this relationship between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda is key, and this was the whole problem with the entire so-called peace process. You can't deal with the Taliban unless the Taliban is going to deal with Al-Qaeda. So, you know, look, Karzai, he's been a big part of this problem over the past two decades, but he's absolutely right on this. Nothing he says about this is shocking. This is, you know, that's the state of play in Afghanistan, is the Taliban-Al-Qaeda relationship remains strong, as strong as ever, and Al-Qaeda has played a role, a significant role, in the Taliban's current offensive.
The quote, Tom, is from Hamid Karzai. We recognize as Afghans all our failures, but what about the bigger forces and powers who came here for exactly that purpose? Where are they leaving us now in total disgrace and disaster? Do you disagree with that in any fashion, Tom, that we're leaving in disaster?
No, I mean, I wrote, you know, more than 3 years ago now, I wrote that this war was lost. The U.S. doesn't know what it's doing. And, you know, that this is going to lead, this is leading to the America is trying to retreat from a war that it's lost. And that's what's happened here. And, you know, I am not inclined to agree with Hamid Karzai on a regular basis, but in this case, I have to. I mean, he's basically right. He's entirely right on this. And, you know, what's interesting about it, too, is remember, Karzai is someone who's played the game of agitating against the American presence in Afghanistan for his own political purposes when it suited him. And now, as the end draws near, you can hear him squealing that the Americans are leaving and that basically everything is very dire. Well, you know, it would have been better to have gotten on board and to have recognized the bigger problems here looming a long time ago for Karzai and others, as opposed to, crying wolf now when the wolf's actually at your gate.
Tom Jossen, Bill Raggio, Foundation for the Defense of Democracy's Long War Journal. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code iHeart, or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Does Friendly have a taste? If it does, it's probably like Hello's peppermint-flavored anti-plaque and whitening toothpaste. Brush away plaque, show Tartar who's boss, and remove surface stains to naturally whiten. Hello's thoughtful and flavor-forward products make brushing your teeth feel like a confetti-filled bathroom dance party. So say hello to Hello with the always cruelty-free, never tested on animals toothpaste that's made to spread smiles. Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life.